Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about Grinny and Monster Maker by Nicholas Fisk. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hi, Adam.
Hoi, hoi. Hello, Ren.
Hey. You ready to talk about some scary grannies?
Do you mean, am I ready to talk about safeguarding issues in the 1970s? Because yes, I am.
I think that will come up, yeah.
So we're talking about two books by Nicholas Fisk, Grinny and the slightly later Monster Maker.
Yeah, and this was a listener recommendation, actually. So thank you, Dave, if you're listening.
Oh my God, I hope they're still listening. Like, when was this recommended to us?
Oh, only last year. It's not that long.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, knowing our updates, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So had you read either of these before?
No, I hadn't even heard of them.
I'd heard of Grinny. And the name had stayed in my mind, but I'd always kind of side-eyed it. The kids in the book do this eyes to the left trick, which is basically side-eyeing. And I think I side-eyed Grinny, much as the kids in the book do. I didn't like the name, I didn't read it. But I did read Trillions, which is not a horror, though it is a little bit uncanny. It's a science fiction book he wrote about an alien dust that communicates by forming itself into patterns. Which did make quite an impression on me, but that's the only Nicholas Fisk I've read up till
now. He's kind of described as a sort of science fiction writer for children, which is quite an interesting niche. I think, like, in terms of comparisons to what we've talked about before, he's probably closest to William Sleater.
Yes, and definitely the slightly... Because some William Sleater is kind of more cynical or a bit nastier than others. Like the view of human nature is quite negative in something like House of Stairs or When the Heads Came or The Double. And there is definitely a bit of William Sleater crossover. I think Nicholas Fisk is certainly more interested in the science fiction side of things. Okay, I think with William Sleater, he's interested... William Sleater's basically Black Mirror for kids, right? Mm-hmm. The sci-fi stuff's very thinly sketched, but he's really interested in the ramifications. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, if there was a doubling or a cloning machine, what would be the ramifications? He doesn't really care much about, you know, what that cloning machine would look like or how it operates. Whereas I feel like with Nicholas Fisk, though he doesn't go into lots of detail about Grinny's home planet, I feel like that's all worked out in his head.
Mm-hmm.
There's some real sci-fi kind of underlying these books, even though you might not see all of it. Like in Monster Maker, which isn't actually so much of a science fiction book, there's a lot of technical detail.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
About how the monsters in the book are made.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... Monster Maker is an interesting book. I think we'll get to that later and talk about Grinny first, because that's the more well-known one. Although I think we both preferred Monster Maker.
Yeah, that's true. But you are right, the Grinny is more well-known. And my edition is the Puffin Modern Classics edition. So it is a re-release, I think, from the 1990s. So from when we were kids. And it's got... a little you'd almost expect it to be an introduction, actually, but an afterword. I think possibly by the series editor or something, by this Chris Powling, sort of talking about when he first read Grinny.
Yeah. Yeah, I have the same issue, the same edition, with with a sort of old lady on the front with bright white eyes and sort of purple teeth in front of a flying saucer, forked lightning coming down. Yeah,
yeah, it looks kind of like a graphic from one of those terrible alien conspiracy videos on YouTube or
But yeah, it's in pretty a good company in the Poffin Modern Classics.
Mm.
With got Watership Down, The Borrowers, The Dark Is Rising.
Yeah, which we'll have to do at some point.
We will have to do, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's clearly quite well liked.
And it's quite a high concept, right?
Yeah.
You know, what if there was an alien invading your home, but it looked like a sweet old lady?
Hmm. it's told through the diary of 11-year-old Tim, who is
you're just immediately laughing even thinking about it.
I just... who's Yeah, a very pompous little boy.
he's precocious, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
So shall I just... I mean, this is only from page 11, so it's from near the beginning. And can I just read this little passage, which I think should give you, the listener, a sense of the character of Tim?
Go for it.
Then father and mother came in from feeding the rabbits. He made a complete bosh of it as usual, saying all the wrong things, making it quite clear that he hadn't a clue about the very existence of great aunts. But she fixed him with her beady eye and grinned and said, "You remember me, Edward." And he re-entered the 20th century in great style, pouring everyone sherry. He gave Beth, who is 7, as much sherry as me, 11, which is typical. Beth was, as ever, the outstanding social success, and shook hands and said, "Oh, what a lovely surprise," and looked more like a telly ad than ever. I suppose it's a graceful accomplishment, but it's also the mark of a little cow. She swallowed the sherry pretty fast and went across to pour herself some more, but Mum caught her eye and said, "Beth," and that was the end of that. I got another half glass later. It was quite good sherry. A manzanilla.
Thank you.
Reading him as Noel Coward perhaps would have read that. But yes, he's a little 11-year-old sherry connoisseur.
Yeah. that's a good passage, because that shows us this great aunt Emma's, later known as Grinny's, main trick for dealing with adults is just saying, "You remember me?" And then they go, oh yeah, of course, great aunt Emma.
Hello, may I help you?
She says she's my great aunt Emma. Mom, do I have one?
Not that I know of. Oh, I'm sure you remember me. Beth, this is your great aunt Emma, the one we're always talking about.
Who did you say it was, dear?
You know my Aunt Emma.
That's funny. I don't,
Of course, you remember me.
Oh, Aunt Emma, how have you been? Will you be staying long?
Which I think is the name of the sequel to the book, You Remember Me. In which another alien of the same race, so another kind of robot alien, is dispatched to Earth in the form of a TV presenter, apparently.
Okay. So yeah, he's She arrives on the doorstep, says, "Oh, you remember me, Millie," and is invited into the family home for a sort of seemingly indefinite visit. Tim kind of records the various eccentricities of a great aunt, Emma, that are at first kind of amusing, like sort of she stares at the family as they get out of the pool naked. She has this odd aversion to electricity. Becomes sinister as Tim's little sister Beth becomes convinced that great aunt Emma or Grinny is not only not related to them, but not real at all.
Cam, she's weird!
Come on, Beth! Great aunt Emma just doesn't like dogs, especially wet dogs.
Tim, Beth, what's all the noise?
I'm telling Mom and Dad about you!
And the swimming pool nudity seems to be, I looked this up on Goodreads, and it seems to be the thing that puts a lot of like modern readers off. So the top most rated review was from a woman who sort of said that this book's not appropriate for children because the family swim naked. And this had a lot of likes. I don't know if it's like...
Huh.
And... there's some truth to the fact that the kids don't seem to particularly care for the swimming, although I don't think their issue is swimming naked so much as swimming when it's cold, to be honest. I can see why Nicholas Fisk uses it as a device, because... and you probably wouldn't get it in a kid's book written today, but Grinny doesn't know anything about the anatomy and the biology of humans, and obviously being on a fact-seeking mission from the aliens, you know, is interested in this, and that's why, you know, when they get naked out of the pool, Grinny looks at this, and obviously that seems really kind of creepy and weird. And I think, I mean, Tim, as a narrator, kind of contextualises it a little bit, and sort of talks about... the kind of free-thinking health set, basically. And it kind of puts in this very 1970s context, right, of sort of people going, you know, this is a period where people went, you know, not everyone, but, you know, there would have been, like, middle-class families, say, going to a naturist colony for their health and things like this. You know, you see sort of documentaries of this kind of period. And... so I think the idea is that the father's on a health kick, and this swimming naked is you know,
yeah. I mean, and it is their own pool, like
Which he said, you know, he says, you know, we do have standards. We wouldn't just walk around naked in someone else's house or leave the toilet door open. But yeah, I thought it was worth mentioning that this does seem to be the most common response to it on Goodreads. Is that the book's inappropriate because of this. You know, it's a small element near the beginning of the book.
The things to object to.
There are a lot of kind of issues around child safety and things in this book.
That's interesting. That would never have occurred to me.
I thought
it's interesting that they have their own pool. That's pretty unusual. The nudity didn't...
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember, does it say what part of America we're in? Whether this is like, because I guess if it's like California, like, I tend to assume
This is England.
What?
Yeah.
It's English?
Yeah.
Oh my God, they've got, what? Okay, well, okay, them having a swimming pool's outrageous. I mean, in America, it seems like, you know...
I mean, can't you tell from Tim's, like, it's like Tim's narratorial voice is incredibly English.
That's a really good point. I think, I don't know, I think I just sort of assumed they were like American new money. it was the swimming pool. I think the idea of, I mean, God, they must be really rich.
Yeah. Well, it's based on Nicholas Fisk had his own swimming pool.
Oh, so. Well, I mean, I guess he must have made a pretty packet of his books.
It's yeah, no one has their own swimming pool apart from Nicholas Fisk in the UK.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, it is an interesting thing about it. Makes me think of the Blumhouse, you know, horror films with, based on, I think the second one based on the Enfield Haunting.
Hmm.
I think so. Basically, it's the second Conjuring film, and it's set in England. Hmm. And you know, this is all set on like, Enfield, I guess, but it's like a housing estate, right? And they go to this house, and then they've got this massive basement. It's like these are like terraced houses, and I was just like, this is not an English house. Like, where's this massive basement come from?
Yeah.
On a long, like, yeah. But okay. So gosh, yeah. So they're an English family with a swimming pool. So I now understand why.
So
they're
it's
able...
already speculative fiction at this point.
Well, I can now understand why they're sat around drinking sherry all the time.
Yeah. Right. So anyway. So the first sign that something is definitely quite wrong about Grinny is that she slips outside and hurts her wrist, and Beth sort of rushes out to help her up, and then runs away without saying anything, and is kind of acting very strangely for the rest of the day, and eventually Tim manages to get the story out of Beth that that when Grinny fell over, she broke her wrist, but there wasn't any blood. That like the skin was split open, and the bone was sticking out, but the bone was made of metal, and there wasn't any blood. Beth says she's not real, and Tim kind of goes, okay, and isn't entirely convinced yet, but
I like that as existential horror, that it's not that Beth says, oh, she's made of metal or she's a robot, she says repeatedly she's not real.
Mm.
I really like that, this idea that, you know, she's not Aunt Emma, and so she's not real.
Yeah,
that she has this, she sort of has this non-existence, that her existence is impossible. And so Beth's way of explaining this wrongness is to keep repeatedly saying that she's not real.
Yeah.
I thought that was really neat. It's at this point in my copy of the book that some young upstart crow has written ass in gold pen before the entry of February the 8th, which I was none too impressed at. So, yeah. If listener, if you were the child who wrote this in the copy of Grinny that I ended up picking up, consider yourself told off and duly chastised, because I was unimpressed.
Yes, that's it's not big and it's not clever.
No, even if that's what you think of the book, you know, you write that in your Goodreads review, not in the book itself.
Ass. Yeah. So the next weird thing that happens is a UFO that appears outside the window. Tim's watching, and he gets his dad out of bed, and they both look at this UFO. There's a description of it. It says, it was far brighter than the moon and had yellowish brilliance. I remember thinking how it clashed with the steely blue of the moon. I also remember seeing the yellowish reflections of its light on the frosted grass of the lawn, the sort of effect you get when you look at a boat with a light on it far out at sea. That's quite a nice description.
That is a nice description. And did you notice what's really different about this scene compared to almost every other children's horror that we've read?
No.
The dad sees the UFO.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah, normally what would happen is, you know, the kids would see this thing and they'd get the parent and the parent wouldn't believe them. But no, the dad gets to see the UFO through the telescope.
Yeah, that's true. Because, yeah, which is interesting, because otherwise this Grinny is quite... seems to fit quite into the kind of genre of, like, kind of demon headmaster sort of thing of kids versus adults. And that the parents are hypnotized by Grinny, but the kids aren't. Yeah, it's true, he does see the UFO as well.
Yeah, so in the book there's a sketch from the father of the UFO, so he doesn't get to take a photograph of it. By the time he set up the camera, the UFO's disappeared. But he does a kind of composite drawing of it based on Tim and Beth's and his own description of what the spacecraft looked like.
Hmm.
And it seems like Grinny, on some level, communicates with the UFO. I don't know if this becomes apparent at this point.
Well, yeah, you kind of get that idea because sort of Tim goes to her room and finds her lying sort of flat on her back and glowing from the inside. And she's sort of, I think she's sort of murmuring to herself. Or there's a slight fluttering, twittering sound, which is kind of what they later call Grinnish, which is her sort of language for communicating with the UFO.
Here it is on page 50. Grinny was lying flat on her back on the bed, with her arms by her side above the covers. She was rigid and still, like a corpse or an Egyptian mummy, but she was luminous. There was even a faint glow through the bedcloths. I remember thinking in a matter-of-fact sort of way, she doesn't seem to need much covering, just one blanket. Because, of course, the light couldn't have passed through several blankets. I went closer, I wasn't frightened yet, and saw another thing. Her eyes were wide open. She was staring at the ceiling, staring at nothing, and her eyes were lit up from inside, like water when you put the lens of a lit torch in it. Her mouth was open. She was grinning.
Yeah. And then just a little bit further on, it says, I think it was the reflection of her luminosity on her teeth that made me give a sort of scream. Sure. It's a detail I really like.
Yeah, that's almost texture of the week level.
Yeah, it was one of my contenders, I think. Her inner luminosity reflecting on her teeth. Yeah, that's a good one. So the kids decide to test Grinny's aversion to electricity with a Wimshurst machine. And this being the 1970s, when children were free to electrocute themselves if they wanted to, they bring this machine into the house.
To be fair, this is the kind of thing I can imagine my dad had as a kid. Like,
yeah.
I've heard about how he had a chemistry set as a kid and literally, like, blew the door off off the garage. So.
Yeah. So it's described as a... This is the antediluvian device with two big contra-rotating wheels and sticks of knobs on the end of them sticking out. You wind the handle, the two wheels turn, static electricity is generated, and you get exciting blue sparks zipping about between the two knobs. So they have this contraption, and...
just knocking about in the house.
Yeah. And they start, like, sort of... Tim and Beth and their friend Mac, and they're sort of showing it off to Grinny, and like, oh, isn't this... Look at this contraption, isn't it? Isn't it brilliant? Yeah, she's getting more and more uncomfortable, and they kind of pretend not to hear and sort of start winding it up, so it's got all these sparks flying around and sort of bringing it closer to her, and then a kind of putting their hands in the sparks and daring Grinny to do that as well. Yeah, it's clear she's pretty scared of this thing. And they only stop when Tim's dad bursts in and shouts at them all. Yeah, they have definitely established that Grinny is scared of electricity.
As well she might be. I mean, electricity is really weird.
Yeah, yeah. It's not an unreasonable thing to be scared of, even if you aren't made of metal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think by this point, Tim is quite convinced that Grinny is not real. But if she's not real, what is she?
Yeah. Well, at first, he's treating Beth's claims like they were claims of the week. but they don't qualify for claims of the week, because Beth is completely right. You know, he says a lot about how, you know, women and girls are just led by their emotions and they're irrational creatures and so on. And
yes.
Yeah, Beth is wise to Grinny from the start. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, is proved to be right. I feel like you're meant to, I don't know, be fairly on side with Tim. Or from what Nicholas Fisk writes, or he's quoted in the afterword, he says that, you know, Tim's basically him when he was 11. And so, you know, he was just sort of putting on. I think there's maybe a bit of an assumption that boys around that age are going to be reading this book and they're just going to relate to Tim.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's good that Tim isn't, like, validated in all his chauvinism, but it gets pretty wearing because there's quite a lot of it.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's aged about this book, is this kind of jocular sexism of Tim's. That
it's wearying. Oh, and they, so Tim and Beth also have a friend, or Tim has a friend called Mac, who comes over, who also gets in on the Grinny conspiracy action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's part of the electricity game to test Grinny.
Yeah. And he gets involved in trying to figure out what she wants and why she's here. And so they do this, that you mentioned, this eyes right trick on Grinny, where instead of looking directly at her, they address a spot 1 foot to the right of her at all times, and this sort of makes her very anxious, and sort of then eventually sort of drives her into a sort of frenzy where she starts speaking Grinnish. And they do this a second time. She gets so worked up, she ends up grabbing Max hand and breaking his thumb.
Does she snap it backwards?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. yeah. She's, and I think that the reason why she does that is that Mac uses her own phrase on her. He says, she's speaking Grinnish, and he says, "Tell us about spaceships or something. You can tell me, Grinny. It's Mac. You remember me." And that's when she grabs his hand.
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty little moment, and I think one of the reasons for genuine suspense in the book and in Monster Maker is you do feel like the kids are at serious risk of harm.
Mm.
Like, there's always the sense that, you know, Nicholas Fisk would be quite willing to hurt, you know, that these children, you know, can get hurt or killed, potentially.
Yeah, yeah. So then that night, the UFO appears again, and Tim goes straight to Grinny's door and overhears her saying something about little difficulty and quite suitable. And sort of realises that she's talking about the planet.
Mostly harmless, to use the mostly phrase harmless. Hitchhikers.
Yeah. Tim confronts Granny about breaking Mac's thumb, and I'll just read this bit. What happens next? Granny says, "I do not suffer from heat or cold or toothache or any such things, as I think you know. Even if you break my wrist, I feel no pain, and it mends itself almost instantly, which is most convenient." I said, "Mac feels pain. You broke his thumb." She said, "You sound upset. If you like, you may break a finger of mine, for Mac." She held out her old hand with the fingers spread. "Any finger," she said. I made some sound or other and flinched back from her. She said, "You are afraid, and quite rightly. It's quite correct that you should be afraid, quite in order. You must not mind, Timothy. You must get used to it. Indeed you must. The strangeness of it all. You must accustom yourself to it." She still had her hand stretched out. Then she took hold of one of her fingers with the other hand and gave a sudden twist. The finger she broke just split open. The skin parted and it split open. The finger was twisted and it was all out of line with the other fingers. There were little metal bones inside the split skin, and some of them stuck out, glinting. I thought I was going to be sick and was floundering about, rather. She soon put a stop to that, however. She said, "There, you must accustom yourself to it. It's a fact of life, Timothy. I am a new fact of all human life."
That's quite demon head mastery.
Yeah.
That's a repetition of logical imperatives, and that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think Grinny is even more alien than the demon head master, because the demon head master, like, seems to basically understand humans, whereas I guess Grinny's only just arrived on the planet, and you know, spends a lot of time trying to puzzle out humans, and
And then sort of the showdown of the book, Grinny kind of explains to Tim and Beth and Mac that her planet is far too overcrowded, and so her species are coming to settle on Earth, and the adults will all be hypnotized, but the children will be enslaved, basically, to serve the new conquerors.
Quite suitable. I see little difficulty. Do not.
Yes, agreed.
You may come in now, Tim and Ben. As you may have guessed, I am a new factor in human life. You are going to have to get used to me.
Are you going to eat us or something?
Oh, my, no. We never eat. We just need energy. You see, we've used up our world.
So now you want this one?
Exactly.
Well, what about people who live here now?
The useful ones, people under our control, will be put to work.
And what about us? You can't control us.
True. We can't control the children. Your minds are so wild, so unpredictable. But you'll either help us, or you'll have to go away.
And Beth is in favour of killing Grinny, pushing her against an electric heater or bashing her with an iron poker. But Tim doesn't think this will be much use because they could just send a replacement. So they decide that they're going to have to make her surrender and say to the UFO that the Earth isn't suitable after all.
There's no sense that Grinny can be reasoned with. Grinny's very much like the Terminator. Beth seems kind of scarily violent in this, but she's also clearly right. You know, Grinny does seem more like a robot than the, I mean, Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's a whole other debate, you know, but yeah, I don't know. I can understand why Beth doesn't have a sympathetic or sentimental response to Gritty.
Yeah. And you texted me after you read this, this, the end of Gritty is just an extended torture sequence.
Yeah.
Which it is.
I mean, they're basically torturing a robot. But, you know, I don't know if anyone listening has seen AI and so remembers the robot torture scenes and that. It doesn't make it any more comfortable. So they're going to try to break Gritty's programming, I suppose.
Yeah. So they do the eyes right thing on her again, and they're trying to project emotions at her. Oh, Max trying to project determination, and Tim is trying to project confusion, and Beth's just going with hate, and she's like, she's muttering, "I want you to die and die and die." Gritty has this instrument that is described as a torch thing. I don't know if we're meant to be like. What were torches like in 1973? Were they quite big?
I mean, I assumed they were kind of bulky.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. So I imagine it's quite a big bulky torch. Gritty sort of let slip that this can be used to punish, and so the kids direct it to punish her instead. She reveals why she's so scared of electricity. It's like some humans are scared of blood. It's her life fluid. they threaten Gritty with this device until she tells the spacecraft that the Earth is not suitable. And then the torch thing tears Gritty apart.
Yeah. Shall I read it?
Yeah.
Then she was on the floor. And there was the metal cutting noise again. And her screams. But they stopped. Just as they were becoming unbearable. I couldn't see much of what was happening, and what I could see I could hardly believe. She seemed to be tearing herself to pieces. You could see the fragments of cloth and patches of her skin, and the glinting metal of her bones. There was a sort of drumming noise. It was her heels and elbows on the floor. Beth was screaming, "I don't care! I'm glad!" and sobbing and shuddering. Her eyes were completely round, and she was staring at Gritty on the floor, still hating her. I thought she shouldn't be watching and put my arm round her, trying to push her head into my chest so that she couldn't see, but she just clawed my arm aside and went on looking. Mac was trying to get the lights to work. I'm glad he failed. And then all the noise and flailing motion stopped. There was just a small dragging, scraping sound. It was one of her arms. It was being separated from her body. It was being pulled towards the French windows by the torch thing. It went on like this. On and on. We three just stood there, cold with horror, while she was dismembered. The limbs and bits of machinery weren't so bad. It was the clothing that made you feel sick. Old ladies' clothes, human clothes, with some busy, vile, alien machine inside them making them heave and twitch and bulge as it cut and ripped. The torch thing was as busy and unstoppable as a rat, never pausing from its nibblings and humped-up scurryings and lunges and tugs. At last it had finished. What had been Great Aunt Emma was a pile of rubbish outside the French windows.
Yeah.
It's a pretty gruesome extended description.
Yeah. I think it's definitely something evocatively creepy about the old lady clothes and the metal. Yeah, the metal arms and stuff.
I mean, it was my first kind of choice for texture of the week, so shall we do texture of the week?
Okay, sure.
Okay. Texture. It's the texture of the week. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was my first choice, and I also really like the Slurks, that are the kind of little monsters in Monster Maker. These are like little stop motion monsters. The kind Ray Harryhausen would have made. I kind of imagine them also as like Warhammer monsters, I guess.
Yeah.
And their first description is this. They were called Slurks. There were 96 of them, all the same. Their bodies were deathly white, like dead flesh left too long in a pond. Their mouths could be opened or closed and were coloured inside with a nasty yellowish hue. Sharp spines ran down their backs, and there was a sinister plumpness around their middles, as if they'd just gorged themselves on carrion. Their eyes were of green enamel over small dish-shaped bright tin cups. Periwinkle had suggested and carried out the enamels. "You must be mad to think of using plastics, Chauncey. Plastics go dull, and I can get you a ghastly glitter at only half the cost." She had been right about everything, as usual, except the cost, which turned out to be very high, as she charged Chauncey for 2 new electric enamelling stoves, which she'd long wanted. Somehow, Periwinkle had got a reptilian slit-like pupil into the enamelled irises. The slits had to be set just so, or the sinister effect was lost. But yeah, I like the kind of enamel surface, and I think in Monster Maker this ambiguity over whether the monsters are just models or actually secretly alive is something that sustains the book, and I think you get that from their first description, because even though they're clearly described as models and we have the materials and you can imagine the texture of the paint, also they're fleshy physicality, you know, the plumpness as if they just gorged on carrion is really emphasised as well, which does make them seem kind of organic and alive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
How about you?
Well, I already mentioned Grinny's luminous reflecting teeth. I got another small one, which is in Monster Maker, the main character, Matt, says he has a nice bouncy radish that he considers throwing at his sister. I just like the idea of a bouncy radish, just quite pleasing. But my main texture I've gone with is from Monster Maker, where we'll get to this, but Matt, the main character, gets a concussion, and there's lots of very good descriptions about the world going a bit wobbly. But this is just after he gets hit on the back of the head. There was an explosion somewhere. Then nothing happened. Then there was grass right in front of him. Grass everywhere. The grass was the wrong colour. Each blade was sharply outlined in brilliant grey light, and the centres of the blades were another sort of greenish white. He raised his head from the grass and looked at the sky. The sky, too, was the wrong colour. It was bleached to a blue-grey-white that hurt the eyes. Even the trees, their branches moving with the wind, were wrong. So far away. Yet they were like rubber sponges, each pore distinct and sharp, but blinding grey instead of green.
Yeah, there's really sharp descriptions in Monster Maker.
Yeah. It's really well written.
It's really well... Antonia recommended it to me, because it's the one that made an impression on her when she was young. Like she'd read Grinny as well, but she said Monster Maker was her favourite. And yeah, I do think that actually his writing has really improved quite a lot by the time he gets to Monster Maker. Not that Grinny's badly written, but I don't know, maybe it was just, you know, maybe he just really enjoyed writing about these little models and the filmmaking. But yeah, there's some lovely description in Monster Maker.
Yeah, so, Monster Maker, shares some common preoccupations of Granny, sort of kind of around animacy, I guess, what makes something alive, and also shares a gleeful disregard for electrical safety. it's about a 15-year-old boy called Matt who is a great admirer of a man called Chauncey Bellow.
Dear Mr. Bellow, my name is Matthew Banting. I'm 14 years old and I want to be like you, the greatest monster maker in the world.
Is that how you'd think you'd pronounce that?
Yeah, that sounds right to me.
Yeah. He's a practical effects and model maker for TV and film, and he has his workshop in the same village, I guess, that Matt lives in, and Matt's desperate to see inside, and he manages to catch a lift with Chauncey when he sees him in the local hardware shop and impresses him with a functioning radio that he's built inside a walnut shell. So he gets to see inside and gets taken on as a kind of unpaid apprentice, ends up working on these creatures called Slurks that you described. There's lots of great descriptions of the Slurks and the Ultra Gorgon, which is the massive beast that Chauncey's been working on that breathes actual fire. The conflict of the book comes because Matt's sister Jan has sort of been taunting him a bit and kind of calling him an errand boy. So in retaliation, he pulls out these 9 5-pound notes that Chauncey had dropped, and he was actually going to return them later. But he's like, oh, look how much money I've got. And then I looked it up, and £45 is about £240 in today's money. But the kind of the news travels about Matt's supposed great earnings, and travels from Jan to her friends to a group of boys led by Darren, who like to ride their bikes up to the studios and toss bricks through windows and generally be a menace.
There's a sort of fight sequence. So they start hassling Matt, and Matt's got I think maybe from his excitement of getting the help out at the studio or the workshop, and also these kind of film dreams dancing around his head, he thinks that he's going to be able to fight them in this sort of heroic battle. I don't know, the kind of adrenaline, I guess, kind of gets to his head a bit, and he gets quite carried away.
But he does seem to be winning for a bit, but until one of the gang kind of slugs him around the back of the head with a log, then like rides off, and that's when things start to go a bit weird.
He's definitely, he's concussed, and then a doctor sees him and is like, oh, that's a nasty bump. And yeah, that's when the reality of the book starts getting a bit wibbly, as you said.
Yeah. And we kind of, as you mentioned as well, the book has this kind of interesting indeterminacy around kind of the models and creatures being alive, and kind of even like before the concussion, when Matt's working on the Slurks, he starts to think he's seeing them wink, or that his sweat on their bodies is this kind of clammy reptile fluid, and and there's a kind of sort of playing with the kind of odd semi-life that the models have, because they'll come to life with stop motion, but they also like physically move because they have kind of wire inside them, so if they kind of spring back into shape kind of slowly in a way that looks like they're alive.
I've said it before, but I just really love the attention that's given to the technical details, the model making. So there's this real focus on how the joints are articulated, and how a certain texture or a certain look is achieved.
Yeah.
We have the character of Periwinkle, who's a makeup expert, and she kind of works on painting the models.
And jewellery. And she's... she's an eccentric artist who's also has her studio nearby to the film studio, and sort of they can't keep her out, but she sometimes just like flourishes her paintbrush and like makes something work like that was not working.
Chauncey, the model maker, is clearly a bit of a grumpy old man, but at the same time, he obviously has this kind of soft spot for Periwinkle and knows that she's very talented, and so kind of plays up to not liking her around, but actually clearly does.
Yeah. So after the fight, This doctor is very old and not very with it, and sort of doesn't really do anything useful, like tell Matt to go to the hospital. So he just kind of wakes up, and he has his face, it says, reminds him of rotten plums and puffballs. Oh. But he tells himself, come on, you noble lad, be brave, be bionic. Which I think I might be stealing as a.
I was gonna say that you should take that self talk, Ren.
Yeah, it's great. I'll put it over my mirror. Be brave. Be bionic. and he kind of stumbles to the studios, but Chauncey sort of presses some £10 notes onto him and tells him that he'll have a job there when he leaves school, and that he should just go home until his face isn't mush. He finds that his bike's been vandalised, and there's a note that says, tonight's the night. So, and in his concussed state, he finds it all a bit too much and is just like, makes himself a makeshift bed in one of the rooms of the studios. But no one knows who's there. But that night, Darren's gang arrive, and it's kind of the end of the day, and Chauncey and his assistant Reg are sort of bickering over their coffee. Oh yeah, and they built this security system because the boys had been throwing rocks and at the studio and stuff, and Chauncey had got Reg to knock up this security system, and Reg keeps saying, are you sure, Chauncey? This could kill someone. And Chauncey's like, yeah. sure.
Health and safety standards in the 1970s.
Yeah.
I think Reg speculates that what they're doing probably is illegal.
Yeah. yeah. Chauncey is extremely unbothered. they remember that they need to switch this on, so... But by the time they have, the gang are already in the studio. So they find Matt, who's asleep, and tie him up. And they also find Periwinkle and tie her up, despite her trying to attack them with a soldering iron. And the gang sort of kick some slurks about and then find the Ultra Gorgon. And... one of the gang who's kind of gone off looking for money or something sort of comes a cropper of Chauncey's booby trap and gets knocked unconscious. And then the alarm sounds, and Matt and Periwinkle manage to escape, and they like run into the Ultra Gorgon's enclosure, and sort of Matt in his concussed state kind of sees the Ultra Gorgon eating one of the gang. He's about to face up to Darren again, but Chauncey and Reg and Periwinkle, Reg and Periwinkle appear and pull him off. And he kind of, they all get out, and none of the gang are actually dead, although somewhat hurt. But,
it's probably a close call.
Yeah, but Chauncey's quite confident that he can defend himself against any charges of child maiming. but the kind of parts of the studios are kind of on fire and Periwinkle's workshop, but the Ultra Gorgon is safe. So Matt kind of cycles back home and is kind of absolutely out of his mind at this point. He's kind of seeing a kind of London Underground map of lights behind his eyes, and he kind of sees Slurks kind of coming out of the bushes and coming for him, and he collapses on the road, and the next thing he knows, he's back in bed, and his family have found it. And the next day, Chauncey kind of picks him up and explains that the things he saw in the night coming alive weren't actually real. Yeah. And the Slurks were just fluttering pieces of paper, and the glinting eye of the creature was sparks from the fire. He's like, okay. And I don't know. I think he believes him in the end. But yeah, it's definitely a bit ambiguous. yeah, and that's pretty much the end of the book. The real horror was teenage boys all along.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a funny book, because I don't know if I'd call it a horror or not, really. It's sort of about horror more than it is horror, maybe. But I don't know, I just think it has a bit more to it than Grinny.
Yeah, I agree. It's got some it's just got some really interesting kind of atmosphere and kind of great descriptions and the kind of playing around with what's real and what's animate. It's an interesting little book.
It is. It might be a little slow for some kids today. I don't know. But then I don't know if... I mean, Grinny would have been too scary for me, but I don't know. I've been at the local primary helping out a couple of lunch times a week last few weeks, and they were talking on about Hugsy Wugsy and who's scarier, Hugsy Wugsy or Pennywise. What would you do if Pennywise was chasing you down an alleyway? I mean, I said when I was a kid, I hadn't even seen Pennywise, but I was so scared of the idea that I used to have to shower with the plug in the plug hole, and I put my foot over the plug because I thought that would stop Pennywise from wiggling his way up the plug hole. But I imagine a demonic, ancient evil clown probably could make his way through a child's foot. to be honest, but
yeah.
I said the thing with Pennywise as well is that the way to defeat him is if you're not scared of Pennywise, then he hasn't got any power. So that seemed to reassure those who looked a bit nervous. Did I tell you though about the conversation I had with one of them about Spider-Man?
No.
Okay, so one of them had a Spider-Man lunchbox, and I said, trying to start a conversation, it's just a little like 6-year-old boy. And I said, well, you know, maybe Spider-Man has a lunchbox. And he said, no, Spider-Man eats when he gets home. And he seemed quite affronted by my suggesting that Spider-Man would have a lunchbox. And I said, well, you know, Spider-Man has to... To be honest, I haven't seen, like, a Spider-Man film since that terrible Spider-Man 3, when Spider-Man was an emo. That's the last Spider-Man I watched. So, I don't know much about Spider-Man. But I said, you know, I know that Spider-Man goes around on the rooftops. He's out and about quite a lot, so he probably does get hungry, and that might, you know, maybe he would want to eat when he's out on the job. And then the little boy said, well, Spider-Man would eat you. And I said, well, no. I said, he wouldn't eat me, because Spider-Man doesn't eat people. And he said, yes, Spider-Man eats people. I said, well, no, I said, Spider-Man's good. Spider-Man, you know, he's not a cannibal. I said, Spider-Man's good, he doesn't eat people. I said, and then he said, well, Venom eats people. And, you know, I don't know much about, you know, super, so I, you know, I couldn't say he was wrong on that. And I said, well, I don't know, maybe. I said, Venom's bad, though, so I don't know, but Spider-Man doesn't. And then he sort of paused and reflected and then said, Spider-Man eats spiders. I left it there, to be honest.
Yeah.
But yeah, if anyone wants to email about whether Spider-Man does eat people, that would be good to know, because you know I'm in the dark. I'm really behind with superheroes, and I know that they have dropped the ante to make superheroes, you know, more exciting or whatever. So maybe in nowadays Spider-Man does eat people, for all I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's not, you know, he's between a spider and a man, so in a way, I guess it's okay for him to eat spiders and people, really. But yeah.
Well, yeah.
Serves me right for patronising Spider-Man by suggesting that he could possibly have a lunchbox.
He could have a lunchbox full of spiders.
As a lunchbox of spiders and people, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. That was our journey into the 1970s with Nicholas Fisk. Thanks again, Dave, for suggesting that. It was an enjoyable read. Do you have a sign-off for us, Adam?
Not before you do the credits, Ren.
Okay.
I can never remember them.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, it's all right. You can... rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. I'm trying to transfer us away from Twitter, so I've made an Instagram account that's going to be porting posts to the Twitter. So Twitter's still there, but neither of us are on Twitter, so I don't really want to use it much. So, but an Instagram account is... I think it's just Still Scared Podcast. Just Still Scared Podcast. So you can follow us on Instagram. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Of course I do. Be brave, be bionic, creepy.
Be brave, be bionic, spooky kids. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.